Is the mic on? All right, well, good morning. For most Americans, artificial intelligence has been the biggest development in technology since the advent of smartphones 15 or 20 years ago, or perhaps even since the widespread availability of the World Wide Web 30 years ago. So we're honored to bring together an expert panel today to talk about some of the many IP issues that have arisen in the AI front. My name is Brian Pandya. I'm the co-chair of the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group. And on behalf of the executive committee of the practice group, we're honored that everyone is here on a Saturday morning to talk about these issues. And if you like today's program, I encourage you to check out the content that the committee generates almost every month, including a lot of content that's been generated by my friend and colleague on the practice group, Michael Friedland.
Thank you. So I'm really honored today to very, very briefly introduce our moderator. Our moderator is Judge Ryan Holt of the United States Federal Court of Claims. I've been told to keep the introduction really short, probably because if I gave an introduction that was long enough to do it justice, we'd be here for 20 minutes talking. So I'm going to tell you just a couple of things about Judge Holt. He took the bench in 2019. He is a graduate of the California Maritime Academy. He's a former Eagle Scout, and he's an inventor on about 5 patents, I believe. But with that very, very short introduction, I'll turn the microphone over to Judge Holt. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you for the introduction, and thank you all for being here to learn about intellectual property and AI issues on a Saturday morning. So this is the Intellectual Property Rights with the Emergence of AI panel. And we have a group of wonderful panelists with excellent array of experience and insights into law and policy considerations on this important issue. So my plan is to read a brief description of what our panel will discuss, and then go forward with reading biography intros for each panelist in order that they will speak. And in the process of beginning the introduction to the panel, myself and Jordan Gimbel from Microsoft will go ahead and read a brief explanation of some of the technological processes for AI in order to help frame the issues. The order of panelists is as they appear in front of us, and I'll just go ahead and read everyone's name and title now before I go into a biography of Jordan. So first up is Jordan Gimbel, the Associate General Counsel of Microsoft. Second is the Honorable Daryl Issa, U.S. Representative from California. Third is the Honorable Paul Michel, the former Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. And then finally, sitting right next to me is Commissioner Melissa Holyoke from the Federal Trade Commission. Beginning with Mr. Gimbel, the Associate General Counsel at Microsoft, he manages the Open Innovation Team at Microsoft, which he joined in March of 2024. The Open Innovation Team sits within the Intellectual Property Group. The team focuses on and participates in multiple modes of intellectual property and open innovation systems, including copyrights, trade secrets, open data, and data acquisition practices. Prior to joining Microsoft, he was the Deputy General Counsel at Twitch, managing teams responsible for global litigation, enforcement and compliance initiatives, government inquiries, product advice, trust and safety initiatives, and the privacy program. Before Twitch, Jordan served as the head of global brand protection, domains, and copyright at Yahoo. Also previously worked at Jones Day, where we overlapped, although we were in different offices, as a member of the Intellectual Property Group and focused on litigating matters ranging from copyrights to patents. Finally, Jordan is a Fulbright scholar in Sweden and holds an LLM from Stockholm University on IT and completed coursework in a second LLM program at the European Union. So to begin, a brief description of how generative AI models are trained and operate. And Jordan will begin with that, and then I'll come back with a little bit of a primer on how these systems work. So go ahead, Jordan.
Sure. Thank you, Judge Holt. And I just want to kind of depart from regular programming to say thank you to the Federal Society for extending the invitation to me in this practice group. I'm thrilled to be here. This is my first Federal Society event, and I attended all the conferences yesterday, and I really was enjoying the discourse and the dialogue, and so I'm excited to have that same discourse and dialogue with you in the audience today. So to start, as Judge Holt mentioned, I'll read a little bit of remarks around kind of what are generative AI models. And we'll start here with the AI is the science of machine learning from experience, adjusting to new inputs, and performing human-like tasks. The federal government defines artificial intelligence as, take off my glasses for a second to read this, a machine-based system that can, for a given set of human-defined objectives, make predictions, recommendations, or decisions influencing real or virtual environments. Artificial intelligence systems use machine and human-based inputs to perceive real and virtual environments, abstract such perceptions into models through analysis in an automated manner, and use model inference to formulate options for information or action. Now, the biggest conflict to present is what's referred to as the generative AI models. And those are generally understood to refer to when content is generated from scratch using some form of machine learning algorithm. ChatGPT is an example that we're all familiar with, something that launched about nearly 2 years ago, November, around the same time period. It's an AI tool that's based on a large language model. Judge Holt, back to you for how these systems work.
Yeah, so how do these systems work? So type that into an AI system and the response is really well and totally legal. doing a bit more research into this, we've come up with an agreed upon description. Many AI systems work by combining large sets of data with intelligent, iterative processing algorithms to learn from patterns and features in the data they analyze. This type of processing is often referred to as computational analysis, and it is typically applied to a large training data corpus comprised of millions or billions of tokenized data elements. These are the AI inputs. A token is a sequence of characters that are often found together in the corpus of training text, usually made up of four letters or numbers. Raw data is collected by the model developer and is subsequently transformed into an AI training corpus of tokenized data. Raw data may include everything from machine-to-machine data, e.g. satellite transmission data, and trade statistics to published materials, blog posts, and website content. However, raw data is not typically in a form that is suitable for AI training. Instead, raw data must be transformed through a data preparation process into machine-readable tokens that can be computationally analyzed by a machine. Training data will often ultimately appear as a sequence of tokens that stretches across the entire AI corpus. Now, with that, we'll hand things back over to Jordan to conclude with the discussion of, does the AI model contain a copy of the entries in the raw data set used for training, and his opening remarks?
Thank you. So let me answer that question definitively. No. AI-trained models do not contain a copy of the raw data that are used in the training process. Instead, the model contains statistics, such as the likelihood of a token following another token, whether that's the understanding of the word dog and bone and that relationship that happens there in the literature and text. And once trained, the model does not need the data it was trained on. It can run independently of such data. A trained model consists mostly of the weights, which are the parameters of the neural network that are the result of translating the inputs present in the training data into data points understandable by the specific model. When a user makes a request of an AI tool to generate a work, such as an image depicting lawyers speaking on a panel, the model is working from the abstract concepts developed during the training process. Finally, the more data available, the better the model, which translates into more accurate weights that are used to produce better outputs. For this reason, model developers seek out large and diverse data sets to ensure that the model can make predictions or recommendations with minimal risk of inaccuracy. Now, we took that moment to make that description because I think it's important to set the context and backdrop for a lot of the litigations that you read about that are occurring in this space when it involves copyright claims or tangential copyright claims against model developers. I want to take a moment to just kind of give you some stats that I've collected over the last few weeks I want you to put an asterisk next to your notes, to the extent you are taking notes, because this changes weekly, daily, in terms of some of the cases and where they're at. So I will give you these stats, but please be aware that some of them might be outdated in terms of, is it 35, is it 34, is it 36? So at the moment, last I kind of did this collection, there are around 35 cases in the US over that it relate to in some way to AI. 30 of those cases, well, there are 30 claims for direct copyright infringement, 17 claims for vicarious copyright infringement, 17 DMCA 1202 claims. I'll speak about that and explain that in a second. 16 unjust enrichment claims, 14 unfair competition claims, and 12 kind of negligence, confidential claims, and other types of claims. Now, when you look at the cases in terms of where they're at, in terms of the motions to dismiss that have been filed, and the claims that have survived, in a lot of cases, the courts have struck down the vicarious copyright infringement claims, the DMCA 1202 claims, the unjust enrichment, the unfair competition, and the negligence claims. And so what we have really left in these disputes essentially boil down to, and I'm generalizing this, however, the direct copyright infringement claims. So what are the arguments in these cases? Well, some of these cases allege that the copies made in the training of the AI model are infringing, the reproduction, the raw data set that is prepared that we just spoke to. Some cases allege that the outputs of generative AI are substantially similar to copyrighted works and thus are infringing. Several cases have tried to argue that the models itself is a derivative work of the training material. And then more recently, with the case the News Corp filed against Perplexity in October, in late October, cases have begun to distinguish between training uses and grounding uses. Okay, so let me return to some of those cases where we talked about the copyright claims and the non-copyright claims. So why do we have those claims, the DMCA and the state law and claims? Well, one thing to consider is that you have this variance in these cases because the only way to obtain statutory damages and fees that are available under the Copyright Act for your work is you need to essentially register your work within 90 days of publication. That's generally speaking, there are some exceptions. So in many cases, you know, other than really non-institutional kind of large, well, sorry, with large rights holders, those are the parties that are very good about registering their works right away within that 90-day period. But many of these cases don't involve those parties. And so that's why you have these either state law claims or you have the 1202 claims that that are being brought by those parties because they haven't taken the steps to register their works within the 90-day period. Now, if you don't do that, that doesn't mean the damages aren't available to you. It just means the actual damages are available to you. And so far, the plaintiffs are struggling to show that they suffer some damages when their works are used as part of the training and AI system. And quickly take a second to unpack the 1202 DMCA claims and explain that. A party can bring a 1202 claim without a copyright registration, and a 1202 claim generally is about the removal of what's referred to as CMI, copyright management information, which includes information such as the title, the copyright holder, or other identifying information in a copyright notice. 1202B restricts the intentional, and that's a key term there, unauthorized removal of CMI, as well as distribution of work stripped of CMI, knowing that it will conceal an infringement. So now I'm going to turn away from the active litigations in the US, and I will use my remaining time to talk about three particular themes that consume a large part of my work at Microsoft. First, international norms. So we have the fair use doctrine, that's what these cases are really kind of focused in on, as I explained, in terms of the direct infringement claims still outstanding there. And that's the balancing test under Section 107. But in most cases, when you get outside the US, you don't have the fair use doctrine. You might have something that's referred to as fair dealing, which essentially boils down to sometimes a list of exceptions that are identified and defined under the law. But at the same time, the laws of certain countries over the last 5 years have made updates, and that they've introduced the ability for parties to engage in what's referred to as text and data mining. I'm going to read what that definition is as it's defined under the EU law. Text and data mining is defined to mean any automated analytical technique aimed at analyzing text and data in digital form in order to generate information which includes but is not limited to patterns, trends, and correlations. So what you have are laws in the EU in particular that's looking at text and data mining, and what they're doing is they're creating an exception to the exclusive rights under copyright for text and data mining activity. They're saying reproductions and extractions of works and other subject matter for the purpose of text and data mining is permitted. EU law does have a limitation on that in Article 4 of the copyright of the EU Directive on Copyright, which is that the exception only applies on the condition that the works, that the use of the works or their subject matter has not been expressly reserved by the owners in an appropriate manner. That's the opt-out that you might have heard to. Now, this is similar when you go to other countries. Japan and Singapore similarly have an exception to the exclusive rights to engage in text and data mining analysis. Japan refers to as computational data analysis. In those countries, you don't have this limitation, so you don't have the opt-out or the reservation of rights. So there are certain safeguards or conditions that apply there, in particular when you're engaging in data mining or computational analysis. One example is that the work must be lawfully available for those exceptions to apply. And I mention all this because it presents a contrast to the events in the US in which we will be waiting for some time for certainty from the courts on the fair use analysis. So two other quick points. So meanwhile, what are we doing? We have the US courts that we're waiting for some certainty on the fair use analysis. We have this international patchwork regarding kind of codified exceptions around the ability to perform text and data mining for purposes of AI training. Well, what are we doing at Microsoft? We're thinking about giving, and we are giving, authors and copyright owners agency over how their works are used within AI. The norms that exist within search provide us inspiration. For decades in the search space, if people are familiar with this, web publishers have relied on a series of machine-readable signals associated with robots.txt file or the HTML headers to identify whether they want to crawl or to index their site, and even to identify so far as how much information should be included in that search snippet. So that's the inspiration we're looking for in terms of giving copyright owners and authors agency. And that's the norms that we're working from when we're giving them signals that are specific to AI training so that a publisher or copyright owner, you know, regardless of whether they're based in Japan, the EU, or the US, and we've been doing this since 2023, they can use these specific controls to manage how their works are used in AI. They can use certain predefined signals to tell our crawlers to avoid ingesting information for the purpose of AI training. And these are the voluntary kind of steps that we're taking. Second, I want to quickly mention one other thing that we're doing is we're thinking about the idea of how we can bring data back into the ecosystem. And in one sense, how we're doing that is we have a long history of working through open data campaigns and open data initiatives at Microsoft. In fact, for the last 5 years or so, even before AI was kind of on our roadmap, we were thinking about getting together. We were doing campaigns with other companies where we were taking data sets and giving those to ways that researchers and other parties can use for societal benefits. And now we're thinking about expanding that. We're working with libraries and other institutions to consider how we can help fund them and take works that they've digitized and make those available in open data commons. And eventually, what we're moving towards and what I'd like to propose is that the government in this next administration can consider something along the lines of a data moonshot. I can talk about that in a second. But to wrap up, at the end of the day, you know, what we're talking about here is how we're striking the crucial balance to protect innovation and protect expression. And that's it for my remarks. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jordan. Moving down the line in the panel, I have the great honor of introducing Representative Daryl Issa from California's 48th District. Congressman Issa's district includes regions of both San Diego County and Riverside County. Congressman Issa was born in Cleveland, Ohio, enlisted in the U.S. Army at age 17, and obtained the rank of captain. He received an ROTC scholarship and graduated from Siena Heights University with a degree in business. In the private sector, Congressman Issa served as CEO of a California-based technology company that he founded and built in the mid-1990s that became the nation's largest manufacturer of vehicle anti-theft and auto security devices. I'll note that my first car had a Viper alarm system. I appreciate that. He was named Entrepreneur of the Year in 1994. He served as chairman of the Consumer Electronics Association, an organization of over 2,000 technology companies. Isa, this is the first time that I've ever been on a panel where someone has more patents than me. He's the holder of 37 patents and is dedicated to protecting intellectual property rights. From 2011 to 2015, Isa served as chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, is now a senior member of the House Judiciary and Foreign Affairs Committee. He's also chairman of the House Judiciary Committee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet, serves on the House Intelligence Task Force. This Congress, he's introduced several bills related to intellectual property protections and the federal judiciary, and most recently, Congressman Isa has announced the Preventing Abuse of Digital Replicas Act, or PADRA, which would prevent the voice, image, and likeness of individuals being used in the age of AI. And with that, for your opening remarks, go ahead, Congressman Isa.
Well, thank you. The introduction is always better than my presentation, so I do appreciate that. One of the honors that I have that was mentioned is that I serve on the AI task force, and the chair of that task force is Jay Obonoti. Jay's not a household word yet, but he will be, because the reason he got that position is that 30 years ago, he got his degree in AI from Stanford. And I think when Brian was introducing, you know, what happened 15 years ago and 30 years ago, and saying that AI could be as large, it's sort of interesting that 30 years ago, AI was already crucial to the gaming industry in which Jay made his money by making, you know, things that children of all ages, including myself, play. The fact is AI is not any newer than the school books that all of us took to learn how to think in a way that allowed us to make a decision. There are some differences. AI, three decades ago, was a model where you could predict based on the input, the output. All the variables were there, but it didn't give you, except for randomization software, it didn't give you different outcomes every time. It didn't think in a way that took it beyond what it was told to think about, because it didn't add additional thinking, but it did in fact adjust to events. As a matter of fact, all the way back in the 1970s when I was in the military and we were doing real-time casualty assessment, we were able to fire lasers and look at the model of what was fired and what originally was generated as a kill, no kill, but we could adjust that based on input back, learning model. Of course, then it was $20 million to do a very small experiment for a very short period of time. What's happened is we are now on our way over the next decades to doing everything that your brain does, except do it with about 17 watts of power. We haven't quite figured out how to do it with watts, not megawatts. But that's not where we are today. Where we are today is simply models that in fact take and duplicate our learning process and then create what I would call semi-free association. As humans, we do free association constantly, and that's part of how we learn. These models don't yet do that, but they will someday. And it's one of the reasons that the light touch toward legislation, which is my part of the three branches, is so critical. Do we want to make sure that, as the title of it, and PADRA always has to be Preventing Abuse of Digital Replicas Act, we're simply saying that what was wrong for a human being to do but now is so much easier and quick for a model to do has to be protected. And we've seen it where we've seen actual events where somebody is duplicated for purposes of making them, the public think that they're advertising or promoting a product. No question at all, everyone in the audience, everyone in America would say there ought to be a law. We're now trying to do, there ought to be a law. But I will say that every day I'm faced with colleagues who come up and say, I've got a bill or I've got an idea of how we're going to stop AI abuse. And that, unfortunately, goes back to the whole concept of basically, if man has the right to do something, why would we limit the machine's right to do exactly the same thing? And I bring that principle because it's only principles that are going to allow us in Congress to act appropriately. It's only you on the courts. Now, some of you will be given a side. I know you will represent your side. But for the judges and, if appropriate, juries, they're going to have to apply a number of principles. Existing law, of course, is a principle. But also common law, which I will go back in closing and say, if you and I in the room can do something, why would we say that a machine doing the same thing a human would do should be decided vastly differently? That principle, if applied, will make case law and legislation much easier to deal with. I'm going to close with one thing, because Jordan and I and Brian, we were talking on the way in, and the word moonshot came out. And I hadn't heard the word moonshot in our discussions, but I'm going to pick up on that just for a second and say, all of us in this room look and say, especially at a time when we're returning to the moon, moonshots are critical. AI, if we can find enough energy, and if we don't limit the input data in a way that makes these entities narrow-minded, then moonshots in some critical areas will occur. And I'll just give you one. And we talked about government data earlier, and I'll leave that for later if it's brought up. But everyone in this room has a medical record today. Everyone in this room might have a disease, but every one of us has something that could and will eventually attack our body. No doctor in America, no radiologist has looked at every X-ray and every mammogram and every fill in the blank. But it is conceivable in the near future that we could, if allowed, ingest every piece of information about every patient, including every DNA that is associated with that person, eliminate the who's who, but retain the ability to know outcomes. And in a very short period of time, cause and effect, connections to things that no one doctor could ever see, could allow us to find cures and preventions that we can't even imagine. The ultimate moonshot is our very ability to live better and live longer. That moonshot will not occur if we do not take an open mind toward the idea that the greatest doctor, the greatest scientist ever born, will in fact be born out of AI. Thank you.
Thank you, Congressman Issa. Next on the panel is the Honorable Paul Michel, former Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Judge Michel was appointed to the Federal Circuit March of 1988 by President Ronald Reagan. In December of 2004, he assumed the duties of Chief Judge. He served as the Chief Judge until May of 2010, after serving more than 22 years on the court. He retired from his lifetime appointment to be free to speak out on the national need for better patent policy and protection of intellectual property and the vital unmet resource needs of the courts, the Patent and Trademark Office, the International Trade Commission, and other IP-related agencies. In his years on the bench, Judge Michel oversaw thousands of appeals and wrote over 800 opinions, approximately one-third of which were in patent cases. Prior to his appointment to the bench, Judge Michel had a variety of positions, including assistant district attorney and later deputy district attorney for investigations in Philadelphia, a second lieutenant in the United States Army, Assistant Watergate Special Prosecutor, Assistant Counsel to the United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Deputy Chief and Koreagate Prosecutor for the Public Integrity Section of the U.S. Department of Justice, Associate Deputy U.S. Attorney, and finally, Counsel and Administrative Assistant to U.S. Senator Arlen Specter. With that, Judge Michel, please share your opening remarks.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here with the Federalist Society lawyers and associates and to be a part of this panel. I want to try to take the most high-level view possible to simply suggest that it is critical for our country to get AI right. It's critical for our country to get innovation right. And that means we need to integrate effectively, fairly, cleverly, IP rights with AI potential. Congressman Issa very dramatically pointed out what AI can do in the realm of human health, and what could be a more important realm than that. And there are many other technologies and areas of human activity that also can benefit hugely from the development of artificial intelligence models and their use. But we need to do this very cleverly to be effective. I want to just address a couple ideas. The first is that what we're mostly dealing with in the patent realm is what I would characterize as AI-assisted human inventions. So the issue of whether non-humans should be able to get patents isn't on the table now, and I'm not sure it will ever be on the table. So with a focus on AI-assisted inventions, it brings back to mind computers have assisted inventors for decades. Microscopes are another example of a tool used by creative people to generate new inventions. But it's a tool used by a human. It doesn't replace the human. So that's a good frame of reference, I suggest. Now, in the specific circumstance in which we find ourselves, in my view, there's a lot of very sloppy thinking and careless expression talking about AI by many people. So, for example, the prior administration, that is the outgoing administration, issued an executive order about AI. To my eye, that executive order was based almost entirely on politics, ideological assumptions, and no real experience, analysis, data, or insight. And of course, subordinate levels of the government had to comply. So the director of the U.S. Patent Office was required to issue guidance and did on two occasions earlier in the year. And I think the guidance showed the flaw of the executive orders. It was based on assumptions, and it created huge problems. For example, patent examiners who are already overburdened may be required under that guidance to deal with three times as much documentation as they already have to deal with, which is already too much. The burden on inventors to justify their patent applications is not only a question of documentation, it's also a question of practicality. If an inventor has to document every single conversation, I'll call it, with the AI model, of which there might be hundreds, there might even be thousands, and document every output that each iteration of instruction to the model yielded, we're talking about a huge burden of record keeping and retention and verification of accuracy and so on. So I think that the guidance issued by the Patent Office was very ill-advised. I hope that the new director, whoever it turned out to be, will reverse that guidance and do something much more practical and reasonable. Again, stepping back, the key here for getting this right is for all the actors in this drama, if I can use that imagery, to understand their role, to coordinate their role with the proper roles of all the other actors. And that's why I'm so appreciative of the interest and insight by Congressman Issa. the legislature has a key job, key responsibilities. They're the policymakers. They're the lawgivers under our constitutional system. The courts are supposed to apply the laws that Congress mandated and at the margins interpret them. But the courts are not supposed to be policymakers. They're not really suited to be policymakers. They can't do it very effectively. So they have limits, but they have benefits too. And the coordination back and forth between the two branches is so important. Same thing with the executive branch agencies, not just the Patent Office, but the Federal Trade Commission with Commissioner Holyoke here and many other elements of the executive branch and what's sometimes called the Fourth Estate. They all have their role, they all have to help, and they have to do it in a coordinated, reasonable way. So I have to commend the Federalist Society for focusing attention on these issues, but also on the different actors that need to operate as a team in order to maximize the benefits for our country of these kind of potentials. So I think that I'll just end by telling you a quick little personal story. When Congressman Issa was a new member of Congress, relatively new member, he called me up when I was the chief judge and asked me, could I come down and talk to you about patent rights? I said, of course, I'd be honored. And he did. He took the trouble to come down. We had a conversations. We've had off and on conversations for years. And this is the way it should be. Judges should not live in some silo where they never talk to the lawgivers or the executive branch people. But it's become too much, I think, the tradition of many courts to live in a little silo by themselves and not consult people who live in the real world, not only political policymakers, but also scientists, inventors, investors, and the other important actors in our economy. So I'm hoping that by this kind of presentation, we can figure out better ways to work together in order to actually realize the fabulous potential for human betterment of AI-assisted work. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judge Michel. We always appreciate advocacy for judges to not live in bubbles. Our final panelist is Commissioner Melissa Holyoke from the Federal Trade Commission. She was sworn in as a commissioner to the FTC in March of 2024. Prior to the FTC, she served as Solicitor General of the great state of Utah, where she oversaw civil appeals, criminal appeals, constitutional defense and special litigation, and antitrust and data privacy divisions. As SG, she also managed multi-state matters, including those involving consumer protection and antitrust claims. Prior to her service as Solicitor General, Commissioner Holyoke served as the President and General Counsel of Hamilton Lincoln Law Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based public interest law firm, and in other public interest attorney positions with the Competitive Enterprise Institute and the Center for Class Action Fairness. Commissioner Holyoke has argued cases in the 5th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and D.C. circuits, and she began her legal career as an associate with O'Melveny & Myers. Commissioner Holyoke, for your opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Judge Holt, and thank you to the Federalist Society. Thrilled to be here among friends and with my esteemed panelists. I'll begin with my standard disclaimer that my views today are my own and do not necessarily reflect those of the other commissioners or of the Federal Trade Commission. So when I told my husband I was doing an IP and AI panel, he said, well, you're not an IP lawyer. I said, honey, I'm a federal official. We declare ourselves experts of anything we want. But in all seriousness, since being confirmed, I've worked on a number of matters related to AI, and often in the context of the FTC's consumer protection laws. In my initial remarks, I'll describe some of those matters, and then spend some time applying those to the principles, applying those principles to some of the work and issues that we're talking about today. So for starters, the FTC has experience applying legal tools and frameworks Congress has given us to new technologies, and that includes artificial intelligence. In fact, in late September, the FTC announced a sweep of cases brought against deceptive AI claims and schemes, and I voted for four of these cases. But I dissented in the fifth, And this case was brought against a generative AI company called Writer. As its name suggests, Writer helps users quickly draft different types of written material, blogs, emails, articles. One of Writer's offerings generates product reviews, consumer product reviews, based on the user's prompts. So focusing on this service, the FTC brought an unfairness claim under Section 5 of the FTC Act. The FTC also claimed this particular service gave consumers the means and instrumentalities to generate false and deceptive reviews. There were several reasons I dissented from the majority's approach, and I'll mention two here. First, in Writer, the FTC effectively punished a company for providing a neutral AI tool, one that was not intrinsically deceptive. No, tools can always be misused. But that doesn't mean the tools creators are or should be treated as liable. And the second reason is that contrary to what Section 5 requires, the majority's approach failed to account for benefits from Writer service. And then, nevertheless, the consent agreement banned Writer from offering it. So for any entrepreneurs watching, and I'm hoping one day to get any patent, much less 5 or 37, the takeaway here is do not innovate. Instead, the message is tread carefully. So every neutral application of AI, applications that consumers get value from, could be unlawful. As I said in my dissent, this is wrong when the commission chills innovation by using settlements to advance claims or obtain orders that a court is highly unlikely to credit or grant in litigation. Tying this back to today's discussion, I believe the FTC's misguided approach in Writer illustrates how not to apply existing legal frameworks. And that negative example is useful in considering AI regulation in general. So in evolving industries, misguided policy and enforcement, like the judge was talking about, will harm consumers and competition by stifling entrepreneurship and progress. Enforcers should faithfully execute the law, but the key is to robustly enforce the law as Congress enacted it, not as we would wish it to be. Parenthetically, I'll gladly note an innovative, aware approach is consistent with the priorities of this incoming administration. President Trump's platform critiqued the current administration's approach to AI as hindering innovation, among other things, and instead supports robust AI development. Such an approach will not only benefit consumers, but also help as we compete in the global marketplace. On a practical level, what does all this mean for today's topic? One part of our discussion today is how we can move forward in a world with AI, given existing laws. I believe a governing principle for regulators and enforcers should be a strong awareness of the importance of a nascent industry. So even as we robustly enforce the law, we must do so with clear-eyed understanding of market realities and relevant trade-offs that affect incentives to compete. To put a point on this, AI is obviously dependent on access to data. For example, consumers' data and content can be useful to train large language models, LLMs. So whatever effectively determines the terms of access to data, whether consumer protection, copyright, or contract law, will have a direct impact on this emerging field. That means it's important to avoid the missteps, as in Writer, in misapplying the law through settlements to restrict conduct that Congress has never forbidden. A few more observations. In considering whether collection and use of data may violate Section 5 of the FTC Act, it is important that an AI company not lie to consumers about how their data may be used. It's worth asking whether company practices actually line up with a consumer's reasonable expectations. Likewise, if we seek to apply our unfairness authority to companies' data collection practices, we must be sure to robustly understand the costs and benefits as the FTC Act and Congress require. The analysis here in the context of AI resembles what Section 5 requires in other contexts, such as thinking through data collection and use for advertising, for example, elevating potential harms over everything else, such as how revenues from targeted advertising help fund the free internet, is inconsistent with Congress's directive to assess countervailing benefits. So as we're thinking about these property issues relative to AI, the FTC's extensive experience in enforcing our organic statute and the cost-benefit analyses it requires offer lessons that may be helpful to policymakers and judges as we seek to further develop and apply the law in this emerging field. And those are my remarks.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Holyoke. Well, before going to some questions that I've prepared, I wanted to open up the floor to any panelists that would care to respond to each other or make any further comments related to comments that others have already given.
I'll just do one very, very quickly for the commissioner, and that is that without trying to be partisan, but to make an observation, over the last 4 years, as you've been in the minority primarily, what I've observed as somebody who goes around the country meeting with businesses is what the chilling effect of that being punished for innovation or being punished for acquisition. And so it's critical, I think, for this country, and I travel outside the world where everyone says that we're terrible because we have all the unicorns. And I think about that and realize we don't just have all the unicorns. We have all the smaller innovators. We have all the smaller roll-up companies. We have all the ability to get capital to grow and to expand businesses. And so I am looking forward to the Federal Trade Commission's shift from assuming that anything that could be misused is bad to assuming that that which helps the consumer and the economy is good unless proven to be evil. And that change in which you look at first, I think, is going to be critical for AI, because if we don't look at AI for its benefits first, and then look at collateral damage fairly, we will always regulate to the detriment of the very unicorns that we're looking for. Thank you.
Let me follow that just briefly by suggesting that we have a hugely innovative society, and what drives that, as the Congressman mentions, is investment of financial resources. Yes, talent and time and so forth, but especially investment of money. And it's critical that the incentives be appropriate to encourage that investment in every level of the structure of companies in America, from the smallest company to huge companies like Microsoft, and leaving nobody behind. Because that's how you're going to get the most innovation, the best human health, the best business, best GDP growth, and all the rest. What I end up concluding is that if there is a specific harm that's clearly in sight, there should be legislation or even agency action against it. The perfect example already mentioned is deepfakes. Deepfakes, using somebody's image and likeness and voice and so forth, that's horrible, it's terrible. Of course it shouldn't be allowed. That's a specific target. But that's quite different from trying to map the whole area of everything AI might do in every realm and, based on assumptions, come up with broad policies and broad rules. That's what I'm against. If it's a specific problem, you can fix it. If it's just an uncharted area, let it get charted by the private sector, by some court decisions, by some legislation, by some administrative action in a coordinated way. But don't stifle it by making a bunch of assumptions about what the broad rules should be. That's the opposite of the way this country has been built. And we ought to stick with the model that we know works of let free enterprise go, except where there are specific harms, and then deal with those specific harms specifically.
Thank you.
maybe to just offer some remarks, because first I want to start. Thank you with the moonshot idea that Representative Issa made about live better and longer. That gave me chills. My wife is, she has the BRCA mutation, and if people don't know what that is, it's a genetic mutation that leads to a high propensity of getting breast and ovarian cancer, and she had breast cancer and thankfully survived. But I think about the genetic testing involved in that, in the way in which, you know, this was 10 plus years ago at this point, the way in which that can kind of get accelerated now that we have AI systems and models that can help doctors and assist them with predictive analysis. That is what these models do. They're getting better and better at predictive analysis, and you are spot on. That's what these fields like medicine and other fields in terms of like industrial, kind of like identifying new industrial components. But with medicine, we need this predictive analysis to work well. Now, let me relate this to the comment that was made by the commissioner with respect to access to data. So why are these predictive analysis kind of models getting better? Well, they have a large corpus of data to work from. And so that's really important to think through this access to data prong. And I think that there's, again, it's back to getting this crucial balance that I think we're all talking about here. You know, I'm not an antitrust lawyer, just like you made a remark that you're not an IP lawyer. But I think I understand that the gist of what you're trying to get to here is there's a balance of ways to approach this, right? And to not be deterministic from the outset, I think, was a theme that's coming out here. And I think that that's right. And, you know, I mentioned the voluntary measures that Microsoft is taking with respect to copyright owners and running this opt-out program so that they have agency over how their works are getting used for training. And I think that's the type of steps that industry can take and think about in terms of trying to strike that crucial balance. And access to data is really important. When you see, I don't know how many people have seen kind of images that that depict and reflect kind of like how people are talking about the tech stack. And you can put at the bottom of the tech stack, let's just put it there as energy, right? Power drives all this stuff. Above that are chips, above that are the data centers, then above that are the models that are built off that, then above that are the applications. Well, what I would suggest is that you put another prong there, but a vertical prong instead of a horizontal prong, and that's data, because data feeds into all these layers and makes this possible.
Commissioner Holyoke, any follow-ups?
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think just like what you were saying in terms of the approaches, we might be doing something in privacy related to data that will directly impact, you know, the ability to collect and use data and in a different area. So something that we're not even thinking about in AI. And I've had these discussions with folks when I traveled to Paris and met with some of the European leaders there. And this is something that they're thinking about too, because they are, you know, obviously have a very different approach when it comes to privacy. But they're, you know, starting to think about, okay, well, what is that going to do now in terms of our AI development if we do have restrictions to the collection and use?
That's true.
One question I wanted to direct first to Congressman Issa is related to a wonderful essay that Professor Susan Dudley at GW Law School, the founder and senior scholar at the GW Regulatory Studies Center, published and is just posted, I believe, on the Federalist Society website. So this white paper is titled, What Lessons for AI Policy Can We Draw from Past Regulatory Experience? And in the paper, she reviews the airline deregulation, biotech regulations, and internet telecommunications laws, and concludes in part, quote, with rapidly evolving technology, the government should let the private sector lead and take a minimalist approach to intervention that encourages competition but protects property rights. An agile regulatory approach to AI might focus on provisions of information like watermarks, redress based on incident reporting, and existing laws against false information. So I guess the question to Congressman Issa, but then the rest of the panel, is this an acceptable, reasonable, early approach for AI issues? And if it is, then what specific regulations could exist in the three areas mentioned by Professor Dudley?
Well, I think Susan did a good job in just five pages, which for a professor is very short. look, it's exactly the point, is that we have models of legislation and models of deregulation that make a tremendous amount of sense, and we have to apply the same thing. And the resulting competition from telecommunications reform, the resulting is a good case. One of the challenges that I think comes out of that is the regulatory side. You know, Congress from time to time has to say to the amorphous, you know, bureaucratic state, thou shalt not. And we're in that situation. The executive order by the president and the regulation coming out of it, which is likely to stifle creativity if not reined in, is an example where we have to figure out how to say it if the next administration doesn't say it itself. And, you know, I'll put it in another way, and it's the classic example that when you see something over here, you look and say, what is it over here? Well, oddly enough, Elon Musk is both a father of AI innovation and certainly is going to be one of the most legendary figures in space of all time. We may change his last name to Von Braun if we need to. But on his space side, it takes a year and a half for each of those virtual daily launches that he now, that SpaceX is doing. They're launching multiple times a week. It takes about a year and a half in the process because the FAA has applied a set of standards to this new technology, quote, new technology, that thinks of it in the most bureaucratic way of, well, we have to make sure that it couldn't possibly hit a bird on takeoff, so to speak. And I'm not kidding, they actually look at migratory as part of the launch process. That concept is stifling innovation as we speak, and they're overcoming it, but overcoming it at great expense, which means that the barrier to entry is raised. If on the AI side we do, without control, what we're doing over here at the FAA on launches, there will not be small companies. There will not be innovation. So absolutely, I think she does a good job of sending us the recognition that not only should we do no harm in the legislation we pass, but we do have a deregulatory legislative obligation, and we're going to have to look at it. And I did mention HIPAA tangentially for a reason. If we leave it to the existing bureaucratic law, we will not have the innovation necessary. And I think Jordan did a great job of recognizing that 100% of all this data, no exclusions, is in fact, once tokenized, harmless to those from whom it is taken. And we have to teach the bureaucrats that it is in fact that harmless. It's not you and I looking at somebody's private healthcare, it is in fact a machine that once it ingests it is not looking at you and does not ever disclose it. But that's not current, and the bureaucrats will not treat it that way unless we act. So I do look at it as a formative paper. Again, I'm sure there'll be more than five pages in follow-on, but I look forward to them. Thank you.
You know, it's been implicit in what's already been said, but pace is really a critical challenge here. AI is developing so fast that the law is left far behind. Policy is left far behind. Government actors' roles are left far behind. So how are we going to catch up and get ahead of this problem so we can maximize the benefits and still deal with property rights and potential harms? One of the things I think, going back to my theme about make sure the right actor is doing what they do well. I criticize the courts for not being very good at policymaking and really not being authorized by law to make broad policy. That's the job of the Congress. But there's a related problem. We have one Congress, but we don't have one court. We have 94 trial courts in America, staffed by about 1,000 judges. And of course, they're then grouped into circuits, appellate courts that review those courts, there are 13 of them, and then there's the Supreme Court. So there's this hierarchical structure. So eventually there'll be clarity in the law. But how long does it take? 5 to 10 years at least. That is way too slow when we're talking about AI. So the courts shouldn't be over relied on to come up with the answers here, because number one, they probably can't come up with the best answers, but number two, it'll be so much too slow as to be almost irrelevant. That doesn't mean that executive branch people should take over. It just means that the country needs to understand what courts can do well and fast and what they can't do as well and can't do as fast. And that's particularly important with this breakneck speed development of everything related to AI.
I think I'll just note a few things. So when I was, prior to joining the commission, I was at the Utah Attorney General's office, and my deputy's actually right over there. And you might remember this, Chris, but back in February, we led a letter, and don't worry, I'm not gonna call on you and ask you about it, but we led a 20-state letter in response to a request for information from NIST related to the executive order on AI that came out in November 23. And we, we had quite a few concerns there. But what we talked about, and this relates to what Judge Michel was talking about, in with respect to PACE, and also talks about the barriers to entry that Representative Issa was talking about with in this emerging fields. The executive order actually requires testing and reporting mandatory requirements that seems unprecedented to have. Testing and reporting requirements for an emerging technology. But what does that do? One of the concerns that we noted in the letter was that this could lead to entrenchment of incumbents when you're setting forth some of these requirements, which is concerning to me when you have these developing technologies that you're not going to have the disruptors that we might want. But also, when you have these requirements for reporting and testing, what does that do to the PACE, right? Slows everything down. So we were very concerned about that and filed a letter in that. But I think all of those we need to keep in mind as we're going forward with thinking about how these how AI develops.
I'll just invite the audience to come up. There's at least one microphone I see for questions. I'll ask maybe one question from the audience, and then we'll go back to some of our prepared remarks. If you'd like to ask a question, if you could, just please state your name and affiliation and make sure that it is a question, not a statement. Go ahead, sir.
Devin Watkins from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. Let's imagine in one of these AIs, in the corpus of that AI is, Encyclopedia Britannica. And after analyzing its data, it determines that the language in that encyclopedia is the best language that it could come up with. And so it decides to just repeat whatever the language was that was in that encyclopedia for a variety of different questions. Is that a copyright violation, or should it not be considered? And if it is, what should be done about that? Or is there anything we can do about that?
I'll start off with the easiest answer to the easiest question is, of course, if all you get is a carbon copy, if all you get is, I'm showing my age, carbon copy. If all you get is the same image, and we've seen that in some model claims where you ask for something and what you get is essentially what already existed, then it's just selecting it. The question is the nuance, of course, is if it's substantially similar, then the answer would be the same. I don't expect it to be substantially similar. I don't expect it to mimic that. And if it does, then you're not really AI. Because one thing about free association is if the only thing you ingested is the only thing you put out, then you haven't ingested enough. And I think that's the important point and the reason that Jordan and all of us want to see more information available for more ingesting so that, in fact, that never happens. That would be my response. It's for the court to actually look at the specific output and make a decision, but your example certainly begs the question of How could that happen? It could only happen if only you ingested that one encyclopedia.
Yeah, courts will make decisions because they're the default in our society. If the other branches can't or don't, for whatever reason, address something, the courts have to because somebody will file a lawsuit, and they will, and they'll do the best they can, and they'll explain their decision, whatever it is, copyright violation, no copyright violation, and then we try to go forward from there. But the problem is the lack of predictability. I couldn't tell you in a given case that would be typical whether something's a copyright violation or not, because the fair use doctrine is so scrambled and complicated and inconsistent. And everybody I talk to in the business world, the investor world, the inventor world says we need maximum possible predictability because we have to take risky, long bet decisions involving lots of money and lots of resources beyond money. So we need predictability. And right now, in my opinion, and I'm not a detractor of courts. I very much love being on a court. But courts aren't magic. They can't do everything right. They can do some things pretty well and other things not so well. And on the problem of predictability, the current copyright fair use doctrine is a mess. And the same thing with regard to eligibility for what qualifies even potentially to lead to the grant of a patent. The eligibility law is a mess. There's no predictability. Judges can't tell you. How can business people tell you if the judges themselves can't tell you predictably? So we've got to get past these kind of problems to have a better functioning society and economy for everybody's benefit.
So, and I'll just, I think we'd had this question also prepared for Jordan. I wanted to give Jordan an opportunity to respond. And specifically, what can copyright holders do when they spot potentially infringing outputs coming from AI systems?
Yeah, thank you. And I think that's the question that was really asked there. And, you know, I don't have much more to offer than the co-panelists offered. I mean, other than to just make the obvious more obvious, which is that there is recourse under the current law, right? That there's a claim for copyright infringement that can be brought, and that the party then works through that substantial similarity analysis. So, you know, I think that sometimes you hear folks kind of throw up their arms and say, there's nothing I can do, but there is, and that the law already has that avenue of recourse.
Well, and I think, Jordan, you bring up a point. The law is available, but earlier you mentioned it shouldn't be in 50 separate states. There really is a question of it. Often you do have recourse, but you may only have recourse in one state, and it may be different in another state. So that's an area where I think we can all agree that there is room for work.
Yeah, there certainly is. And
I finally got the judge's ticklish point.
Well, you know, it goes also back to Jordan's initial point. He has to deal with the whole world. He's dealing with multiple countries in multiple regions, Europe and Asia and so on. So that's a really big complication. And then internally to think, we don't even speak with one voice as a society now on these national scale problems like AI. Of course, it's also a global scale, but the national scale is important too. And to have a patchwork quilt of 50 different AI laws in 50 different states is just crazy. It's going to lead to all sorts of problems and very little good. So a big burden on the federal government to take the leadership role here, particularly the Congress, as part of the reason why so glad to still be in conversation and a weird sort of partnership with Congressman Issa, because that's how we're going to get this stuff solved. Everybody has part of the answer. Nobody has the whole answer.
We'll go to this side of the room for another question. Just remember to state your name and affiliation.
So Paul Brock, and I'm a patent attorney at a firm called Maynard Nexen. And I'm glad that patent eligibility got mentioned, because that's what my question is about. I think the general consensus among patent attorneys is that it is nearly impossible to patent any kind of AI technology right now. But there is an act coming up called the Patent Eligibility, I think, Reformation Act. And I think the last line of the act says that any process that cannot be done by a human is eligible for patent protection. And the way I'm reading that statute, that would completely open the floodgates. Like, you can patent anything that uses AI, because AI is a computer processing huge amounts of data. That's something a human can never do. And so I'm just curious, What are the thoughts? Do the panelists feel comfortable with letting anything that's AI related be patented, or should there still be restrictions? Because the whole point of Alice, which is kind of restraining what can be patented related to software right now, the idea was we don't want to restrict the building blocks of science. So do we want to allow anything with AI to be patented, or do we want to limit that?
Well, of course there have to be limits. And then the issue becomes exactly what limits. Where do you draw the lines? There's already lots of case law about what things are plainly not eligible for patenting and what things are clearly eligible. And then, of course, there's a gray zone where the clarity is less so. This piece of legislation, it goes by the shorthand PERA, Patent Eligibility Reform Act, is an attempt to overcome some very ill-advised and unintended consequences of Supreme Court cases that created the mess that I mentioned that eligibility law is. And I think it's a well-crafted piece of legislation. It's not perfect, but it's worthy of further development, and it's being developed in both houses of the Congress by the people in charge, including Congressman Issa, and that's our system, and we ought to stick with it.
You know, I might, I opened to a certain extent by stealing our earlier conversation about talking about the moonshot. Well, the moonshot's the positive. When you look at patents, and if we're not careful, I'll give you the opposite. Now, I'm the first, maybe the only one to mention the popular word China. But China is a nefarious patenter. And as a hypothetical, but a hypothetical that there are reports may already be in place. If hypothetically you use an AI model and you use it infinitely every day, all day, to look at what's going on in the world, take that input, and then create claims from what you see coming, from the trend. In other words, you don't reduce to practice, you hypothetically create that which is clear and likely obvious that is coming. You can, in fact, have millions of claims within perhaps hundreds of thousands or millions of patents per year, and you simply have to assign a name of an inventor who sat at the machine or is an appropriate engineer. And under our current law, the discovery and the proof that someone in China didn't invent it would be burdensome, and the blocking of other people's technology would be there. And on top of that, once granted, it could in fact limit the person who actually reduces it to practice. That is the scariest thing I ever came up with sober in my life. And it haunts me simply because we can look at case law and we can look at all this, but how do you stop the nefarious actions of somebody who chooses to turn upside down the revenue, whether it's 5G or any other emerging technology that comes from the actual reduction to practice, either by getting credit for reduction you didn't do or blocking the later reduction because you've made it aware, when in fact it's not real invention. And so many of our patents today would benefit from a 100-year-old practice of having to create the model to show that you actually reduced it. But it's not there, and the people at the PTO are in no way, shape, or form equipped to deal with that kind of volume. But in my time in Congress, if I'm lucky to get reelected just a couple of more times, you know, you never know. The fact is, we're going to have not a million applications, but a million grantings a year, and those will tend to have more claims on them. So the volume that is happening, I was honored to have patents in the 4 million and 5 million numbers. I was honored to be over at George Washington's mill when we celebrated the 10 millionth patent. But when, by the time I finish this term in Congress that's coming up, will clearly be over 12 million. The speed of those patents is without AI and without that nefarious conduct is already so great that what Judge Michel talked about as far as the burden, the burden has to be dealt with in a way that it will probably require some legislation. Thank you.
The shortfall is not so much in the doctrine, because a complete conception, which is required for a patent, has to come very close to an actual reduction to practice if it's correctly applied. But if it's loosely applied, patents will be granted when they shouldn't be, and that happens a lot now. There are disputes about the error rate in the PTO, but there is a good new study that suggests it's upward of 30%, which is a totally unacceptable level of error. So they've got to do a better job. The courts also need to do a better job. But that's application of the law. That's where the shortfall is there. I don't think the law itself is defective, but it has to be sharply applied in a very rigorous and consistent way by skillful people in the courts and the patent office, and there's progress that could be made in both areas.
Thank you. I wanted to come back to a consumer protection question, and then we'll go back to the audience in a second. But for Commissioner Holyoake, you had described how consumer protection authorities already exist and may apply to data collection. Could you share a little bit more detail about what Section 5's unfairness authority requires and how that analysis may apply in the context of AI?
Sure, certainly. So Section 5 declares unlawful, and we can go after acts and practices which cause or likely to cause substantial injury, that is, which is not reasonably avoidable, and which is not outweighed by countervailing benefits. And so I think it's important to think about what are the countervailing benefits. So in the example that I gave in the Ryder case, where you have this generative content, this ability to put in some user prompts and it comes up with some type of content, that can provide wonderful benefits for folks and save lots of time-saving benefits. And a terrific example. I think when we're approaching these cases, we need to make sure that we're not taking a narrow view of the benefits, that we're really examining what these benefits are and how they can help consumers. And I'm thinking of Representative Issa and Jordan's comments about some of the benefits that are coming out of AI. I mean, just tremendous things. For example, even when Representative Issa talking about and Judge Michelle talking about some of the problems that AI is creating, voice cloning being misused, and the commission's going after some of those cases. We have, so for example, fraudsters take voice cloning technology and they use it to call up a grandma and say, hey, this is your grandchild and I need money, send me money. And this is happening all the time. What the commission did was create this voice cloning challenge and offered it to industry to come in, and they provided these new ways for able to analyze voice cloning to make sure that it was synthetic and that it was not a natural voice pattern. So you have AI that can help basically confront and combat different AI problems, but just those are just some examples of where there's tremendous benefits that can come from these, and we can't take a narrow focus on some of these injuries without really examining all of the benefits that can come from these potential technologies that are emerging.
Thank you. Next question from the audience.
Hi, I'm John Farmer. I'm an intellectual property attorney in Richmond, Virginia, and also write a tech and IP column for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. My question is about guardrails and whether it should be required that AI operators publish their guardrails or, related to that, publish whenever the government requires or puts the snide on them to implement certain guardrails. To make certain we're all talking the same terminology, I understand a guardrail to be a human-coded limitation or shaping of what an AI would output. Like, it could be something straightforward like don't coach people to kill themselves, or it could be a heavy DEI filter. What I'm thinking about here is protecting innovation, because not only is AI innovative, but users of AI can innovate. And also think of the social media cases where we've seen that social media companies sometimes put some pretty strong restrictions on what can be posted or what will be amplified, and they don't publish what those rules are. And we've seen cases of the government lean on social media companies to not allow certain things out. And so circling back to guardrails, so that we can fully exploit the potential of generative AI, shouldn't we allow the users to know what guardrails have been implemented to shape those outputs? And shouldn't we be especially concerned when those requirements or those pressures come from the government?
You know, earlier when I talked about, you know, a principle of what can a human do versus a machine, that hasn't been applied yet to those social media examples. In other words, we're constantly asking social media to not allow things to be said that clearly humans say all the time. And that's a stifling of free speech. And we're going to have to come to grips with that basic question of, do we, if once you put your thumb on the scale and say, well, we don't want on social media, and I don't care if it's TikTok or whatever, to be able to say or do things that a U.S. senator said on the Senate floor, or the president, or the president-elect said, then you start saying, well, wait a second. How do we write that against our own Constitution? And if we don't lead with the principles of our Constitution, the rest of the world certainly won't follow. Often they don't anyway. So that's one of the principles in guardrails that most concerns me. I certainly do think that, consistent with consumer choice, providing a guardrail for the software that I use might make a lot of sense, where you say, we're going to provide you the tools to decide that you're not going to generate the seven words that famously George Carlin said couldn't be said. Too many people in the audience know those words. But that, I think, the tools are one thing. The thumb on the scale, particularly, I serve on the committee, select committee, on weaponization of government, and I've seen it firsthand that it's very easy for one administration's decision and the next administration to zigzag those guardrails. So that isn't giving you an answer, but it's giving you some of the guardrails under which we can consider guardrails.
Another question from the audience. Remember to state your name and affiliation.
Thank you. My name is Stephen Taft. I'm an attorney formerly of the 2025 Presidential Transition Project. So my question concerns potential tensions or indeed threats from the political right to the innovation of AI, because what I observed is the panel here very eloquently diagnosed threats from the political left. After all, the Biden administration has been the one in power in a position to regulate during the recent upsurge in this technology. But of course now, I don't think it's fair to say for anyone that the political right, the energy there is from elements which may be more skeptical or fearful of the possibilities of AI. There's more of a focus on community, timeless assumptions and values, more of a suspicion of the laissez-faire business wing of the Republican Party. And so I wanted to ask you all, how do you anticipate this playing out in the Trump administration, and how ought the political branches respond to that kind of point of view?
Sorry, I was going to just quickly jump in and thank you for the question. I'd say kind of make it to a nonpartisan question, because I don't know if, you know, to suggest that there was a...
Well, remember, there's the left, the right, the populist. There's actually a lot of things, if you don't use an R and a D, that you can say, you know,
exactly,
are blurred.
But I just want to go back in time and suggest to unpack that a bit, and not suggest that we were just kind of like saying one administration is bad over another in the last remarks, but more just maybe, you know, I'll take this at a, I'd love to hear your thoughts, but I take this at the level, you know, reminds me of what Brad Smith says at Microsoft, which is we need to get people's trust with this technology. And I think that word trust is really important here. And part of the word trust is listening to people and getting information, understanding how people are using these tools, understanding how they're reacting, understanding what their concerns are, and taking that back and thinking about it. And so, you know, I operate on that basis of trust and trying to have those open conversations. And so I think that's a really important value to keep in mind, and whether you're in the left or the right. And I think that, you know, it can, there are perhaps maybe that's when I say the when we talk about the operating principles, I think working on that operating principle of trust is really important. Sorry, I'll let you.
No, I think you're exactly spot on, and thank goodness you work for Brad Smith. One of the examples of a lawyer can converge with a businessman, with an executive, and all be the same person. But you go back to those first principles, and I think if you go there, and I gather you're associated with Heritage and in your role and so on, if you stick by first principles, you reach conclusions that you don't even like yourself, but there's still conclusions you have to reach. And that's where I think that this administration, which is a populist administration, is still going to be bound by what maybe the last administration forgot at times, which is that the Constitution doesn't have a political party. When George Washington was leaving office and he warned against political parties, he was actually shit-talking Jefferson. Okay? There was already two parties, but there still was only one Constitution, and that Constitution protected things against administrations who would like them different. And as long as we're not foolish enough to have another Alien Sedition Act, where we literally attack our enemies with legislation and with the courts, that in fact we are going to be bound by those limitations. And so that's going to be the message that I have, is that the most reprehensible speech, which is reprehensible to me and sweet to the other side, is I have to support, and I will. And so that, it's a challenge, and every generation faces it, but fortunately the stake in the ground on which we have to make all our decisions, and the judge had to make his decision, hasn't changed very much in 250 years.
Well, thank you. So I want to make sure that we close on time for the TikTok debate that I hear starting behind us in the ballroom. But I just wanted to give every panelist a quick maybe 10 or 15 seconds for final closing thoughts or remarks, beginning with Commissioner Holyoake to my right. And then I have two quick final announcements before we say goodbye. But Commissioner Holyoake.
Oh, thank you. And I'm not sure I could say it as eloquently as my co-panelists have said, but that we're just mindful as we proceed forward, both in the courts, in enforcement actions, in regulation, and thinking about how all of those actions, because they will have an impact on how this technology develops, that we do not stifle innovation, that we allow it to flourish, and that we can remain competitive in the global marketplace.
Judge Michel.
In our democracy, competing goals and forces get balanced out best in the Congress that hears from everybody.
And I'm just thrilled that 20 years after Judge Michel and I introduced ourselves and began a relationship, that I'm still here and still somewhat relevant to the process. And I guess lastly, as the senior member of Congress who's not an attorney, I'm honored to be in front of so many Federalist attorneys. Thank you.
Finally, Jordan.
Sure. I think I'd love to just say thank you again for inviting me. And I think that when I talked about trust and listening to people, I think that's what we're trying to do, and that's what I'm trying to do, because we do want to get this right, and we do want to hear from folks. So thank you.
Great. Well, thank you all. So two quick announcements. The location change for this evening's lecture and reception, the 4:30 p.m. Bork lecture has been moved to the International Ballroom, and the reception that follows will be the ballroom's terrace. And then this is the last day to visit the Remnant Trust Rare Document exhibit. So if you have not seen that, then I recommend you do so. With that, let's give a quick round of applause to all of our panelists. And thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting us.
And,